The White House has been discouraging widespread speculation today that stern reprisals, possibly a raid on Hanoi, capital of North Vietnam, will be made for today's communist guerrilla bombing of the United States Embassy in Saigon. This one terrorist act caused nearly 200 casualties, American or Vietnamese, temporarily destroyed a considerable part of the embassy building, and in communist eyes severely damaged the prestige of the United States. President Johnson called the bombing a wanton act of ruthlessness. Senator Fulbright, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, called it an outrageous kind of terrorism. The premier of South Vietnam says this Viet Cong terrorism, this savagery, was not an act of war, but an act of murder. And U.S. Deputy Ambassador Alexis Johnson referred to the bombing as another example of the Viet Cong's readiness to resort to atrocities against civilians, all of which is completely true. But today's bombing is no exception to the established communist pattern. Atrocities against civilians, terrorism, and murder have been the communist chief weapons in the Vietnam struggle for the past decade. Only recently have Americans become the victims, but South Vietnamese by the tens of thousands have been kidnapped, tortured, or murdered by the communists who seek to capture all of South Vietnam by exterminating anyone from highest to lowest levels who seeks to organize resistance to communist conquest. Some American officials urge that severe, punitive action like bombing Hanoi must be taken to avenge the insult of the embassy attack. Others see this attack as a typical incident in this communist war by atrocity. For it is by committing atrocities that the communists hope to win in South Vietnam, a technique of warfare which we will not employ ourselves and to which we have yet to find the effective answer. This is David Wills.
The House Un-American Activities Committee turned a watchful eye today on the Ku Klux Klan, labeled by President Johnson as a hooded society of bigots. By unanimous vote, the committee decided to press forward with a far-reaching inquiry into a series of murders, violence, and terrorism laid at the door of the Knight Riders. The chairman of the investigating committee, Representative Edwin Willis of Louisiana, said a big job lies ahead, and it may be several weeks before formal hearings can begin. In the past, it has been the custom of these investigators to concentrate on communist activity. Now, not only the Klan is being subjected to preliminary examination, but other extremist organizations as well, the Black Muslims, the American Nazi Party, and the Minutemen. Even this does not meet the demands of some of the more enthusiastic congressional investigators. A Republican from Alabama, James Martin, took the House floor today. He called on the Un-American Activities Committee to expand its investigations to include various Negro civil rights groups. He mentioned the Congress of Racial Equality, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. Congressman Martin said in the past he has pointed out communist infiltration of some of these organizations. He then went on to say, "We are against lynching and mob rule and killing, whether inspired by cowardly writers in the night or pious hypocrites agitating in the public streets." Committee Chairman Willis said that preliminary inquiries indicate that shocking crimes were carried out by some highly secret action groups within the Klans. He said these groups are known as knockoff squads or holy terrors. The Klan's imperial wizard, Robert Sheldon, said there are no such groups, and he welcomes the investigation. This is Ned Brooks.
A committee of Congress in the Johnson administration met in head-on collision today on the question of making more of the government's records available to the public. The House Government Information Subcommittee, headed by Representative John Moss of California, has drafted a measure known as the Freedom of Information Bill. It would provide, with certain exceptions, that the government lay its records open on demand. Today, a spokesman for the administration, Assistant Attorney General Robert Schley, appeared before the committee and expressed his flat opposition to the bill. He said it was unconstitutional, that the problem of releasing information is too complex to be handled by a fixed set of rules, that what is released to the public should be left to the discretion of the executive branch of the government. This brought comments from the committee members. Chairman Moss said there are too many persons in the federal government with the power to withhold information from the public. He said as the government gets bigger, the number of reporters gets smaller, and that too many of them get their news from government press releases which tell the story the way the government wants it told. He said he's more interested in what the government does not talk about than what it does talk about. Representative John Monaghan of Connecticut said that Schley, in his testimony, appeared to be saying that the executive branch can do no wrong. Representative Robert Griffin of Michigan said the administration's position would mean that the bureaucrats in the government would decide what should be told to the people. A spokesman for the Treasury Department said the language of the bill was too broad and should be tightened up. He said in its present form, the proposed legislation could lead to ridiculous situations. Committee members expressed the opinion that the administration's opposition might foreshadow a presidential veto if the bill is approved by Congress. This is Fred Morrison.
A special panel of three judges issued a verdict in Akron, Ohio today in the case of old soldier Leroy Dunlap. It was an unusual case dating from 1920. Then, some 45 years ago, Dunlap was involved with three other men in a robbery and slaying. While awaiting trial, he broke jail. Even though Dunlap wasn't present, he was tried and found guilty of first-degree murder. The death penalty hung over Dunlap's life, which he proceeded to live in exemplary fashion. Taking the name Harry Walker, he joined the Army, married, had a son, now has two grandchildren. 6 years ago, Dunlap, under his assumed name, retired from the armed forces and entered the old soldier's home in Washington, where he lived in retirement for 5 years. It was last year that someone discovered Harry Walker's true identity by matching his fingerprints with those of one Leroy Dunlap, wanted for a capital crime in Ohio. Authorities determined that the 64-year-old grandfather should stand trial again for the crime of 45 years ago. The prosecuting attorney said records of the old trial were missing and witnesses were hazy in recalling the facts. He said he would have to let the old soldier go free if Dunlap risked the death penalty again. Dunlap said he would rather plead guilty to a reduced charge of first-degree manslaughter, and his attorneys entered such a plea along with a plea for probation so that Dunlap might live out his life in the soldier's home. The three judges pondered the question and today rendered the verdict. 1 to 20 years in prison for old soldier Leroy Dunlap, who will become eligible for parole when he nears 66 years old. This is William Carden.
President de Gaulle has struck a new blow for French prestige. He is angry with French scientists who don't insist upon speaking French at international conferences and who have fallen into the evil habit of speaking English. It is deplorable, writes de Gaulle, that the French language, which is so remarkably adapted through its clarity and precision of expression to scientific thought, is being too often betrayed by those who have a major responsibility to inspire its usage. The scientists could be forgiven if they felt a little resentful over this rebuke. They are bound to wonder if French is that precise a tool. If it is, why doesn't the good general use it to produce greater clarity in his own chosen field, high politics? In words, he professes eternal friendship for the United States, yet does his best to evict all American influence from Europe and thus to alienate the very country upon whose strength Europe's security depends. He urges all Europe to rekindle a European heritage free from American tutelage, yet offers Europe only loyalty to himself and to France as a substitute for the European political federation, which would be a fitting expression of the European unity he invokes. Many will insist de Gaulle, in fact, is impaled upon the horns of his own dilemma, which, it would seem, won't be resolved until he is no longer around to confuse the issue. Perhaps the moral is precision of thought is good, even and more important than choice of language, even if it is French.